Greetings, and welcome to the Thirsty Mage, the podcast that's equal parts Paragon and Renegade. I am your host and reluctant commander, David Lloyd, and in this episode we go back to the glory days of BioWare for a discussion of the 2007 hit that would spawn a trilogy and beyond, Mass Effect. Joining me is my favorite podcast regular on the Citadel, Jordan Rudick.
So I realized I did the Renegade option at the beginning of the podcast and forgot to clap. So if you're wondering why there's no clap, normally I play Paragon, but for this one, I guess I had to change it up. The Renegade prompt showed up on screen. I had to take it. So, yeah. I also didn't realize when I put in that introduction, favorite podcast regular in the Citadel, I put that in for David, for anyone listening. I didn't realize that. I guess I'd forgotten that joke or that meme doesn't show up until the second game. So I don't believe you actually see that statement anywhere in the original game. So
you jumped ahead to Mass Effect 2.
We'll have to save that joke for the second game when we talk about that too.
That's okay, because I got when we get to my beer, I'm actually going to be talking about something that happened in Mass Effect 2 as well.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah.
But mostly because I want to get it out now, because I might forget about it when we actually do the Mass Effect 2 episode in a few weeks, and I don't want to forget about it, so I want to make sure we talk about it.
So we're doing as much as we can this episode to not talk about the second game. Obviously, you know, very, very much a revered game, well-known, much beloved. But the first game, I think, is still pretty, pretty damn good, and I had a ton of fun blasting through it. We're going to avoid spoilers here, talk about maybe some of the choices that do come up, but not their consequences or what they lead to or anything like that. But maybe when we talk about the second game, we can talk about some of the decisions we made in the first game and maybe how they come over in the second game. Because I think that's what's one of the most interesting things about this trilogy, is that it's a series of three games where you make consequential decisions that will impact who shows up in the second or third games. And what characters say to you, what side quests become available to you. Like, it is a fascinating specimen of a series that we don't have anything like this. You know, I can't think of any other game. And I know I said this with Trails of Cold Steel 4, like, we hadn't really seen a game where for four games it's the same characters and the same story and what they're going through. Mass Effect is probably the closest thing. And it's different because there aren't a lot of major decisions you're making in the Trails games, Trails of Cold Steel especially, that carry forward into future games, and like people don't show up because maybe you killed them or something in one game. But in Mass Effect, that does happen, and I think it's just such a cool part of all three of these games.
Mm-hmm. But before we get too far into it, I have to ask, though, any new? I know we're off to cook the Oreo train now. But do you have any other new dessert that you wanted to discuss this week?
So I've got a lot of things to discuss in this segment, but I'll keep it short because I want to talk a lot about Mass Effect 2. So one thing is, I do think the Oreo segment is going to come back. I'm sure there's people out there that are, you know, distraught over the end of the Oreo segment in the opening of the podcast. So that will come back. One reason I say that is because I went to the import site, and I probably should stop going there, but they've started taking Oreos from China, and there are some crazy flavors there. And I won't give them away here, but I found even more special flavors that I'm just dying to try. So I think the segment will come back a little bit later, maybe after the summer or maybe around wintertime or something. It could be like a Christmas kind of a celebration type thing, but that will come back. For now, nothing special today. I'm drinking some hot cup of soup, cup noodle kind of thing. It's not cup noodle. It's like Lipton chicken noodle soup, but soup in a cup. I actually love those, and I'll have them just like if I feel even like the slightest throat tickle, I might just have one for the heck of it. But yeah, fortunately, I bought a couple packs when they were on sale a couple months ago, so I'm well stocked for getting over a little bit of a cold that I've got now. Everyone in the house had a little bit of, you know, runny nose, sore throat, that kind of thing. Nothing major, but enough to, you know, make you feel a little grumpy. And so, got my cup of soup, got some water, but no treats for me. I suppose the only thing I've got with sugar is my Hull's vitamin C's drop, and I do have a lot of those. So the total amount of sugar from these will probably add up to a few Oreos. So that's my contribution for this week.
Yeah, those Hull's they're potent there with the sugar. I remember back in like high school, just like down in those.
Oh yeah, and I used to have like the regular Halls, like the menthol ones, but like I would go through so many, my stomach started hurting. So I'm like, oh, I got to stick to the vitamin C now.
Especially the ones with the Hall Centers.
Yes,
that was.
Oh, I love those. Yeah, the cherry or the honey lemon ones. Yeah, those were great.
Yeah. Yeah, for me this week. So I had kind of a, I would call it a boring Lagerdale. So I don't really want to get into it too much because the actual beer that I want to recommend to people to try is in Mass Effect 2. And so I want to do it now, kind of get it out of the way, because first of all, I want to make sure people know about it before they play Mass Effect 2. But I also don't want to forget about it. So there's this hilarious scene. If you played Mass Effect 2 before, I'm sure you've come across this because it's hilarious. There's a scene in Omega where I believe it's not in the main bar, but it's in like, there's like a side bar where the Patriarch is located.
Yeah, you go downstairs in the club to like kind of like a side room sort of thing.
Yeah, so if you go to the bartender and order a drink, I think it had like all the eyes, like the multiple-eyed Batarian guy. Yeah, Batarian, that's it. And yeah, so if you go to the Batarian bartender and order a drink, Shepard's kind of like, it seems like out of character to begin with, that he's kind of like, you know, clubbing it and having a good time, and orders a drink. And then all of a sudden he like stumbles to the ground and goes unconscious. Yeah. And it's a hilarious scene because there's like consequences to that happened to the bartender after this, because clearly Shepard's pissed off. So.
Well, I think there's something about in the story, like, oh, he doesn't like humans or something like that. And so it's not the first time this bartender has tried to poison people. So it's one of the very early choices in Mass Effect 2 where, you know, you can go and like give him what for, or you can, you know, maybe let him off. I don't even remember what all the decisions are for that one. But yeah, it's a funny segment. And Omega's a cool place. It's a good like kind of introduction to the game, I think.
But I just remember the line where the guy's like, man, this would have killed any other human.
Yeah, that's great. So, that's great. Yeah.
So make sure anyone who picks up Mass Effect 2 to make sure that you talk to the Balotarian bartender for a funny scene.
Yeah, go get yourself poisoned and then sort him out afterwards.
Yeah. Don't worry, the poison, it's all for show. There's no long-term effects of the poison or anything.
That we know of. Yeah, we have to see what happens in Mass Effect 3.
But you know, this episode is all about the first Mass Effect in the first one of the trilogy that came out with the Legendary Edition. I guess up front, I'll just say that so we both played through the game, and Jordan played the Legendary Edition, which is the new upgraded high def version with like the 4K visuals and that sort of thing. But I ended up just playing the original version that's available on Game Pass. So there are like upgrades, because Xbox does do some, I don't know if I wouldn't really call it a remaster, but they at least make it look really nice on the like on the Xbox. Like I'm playing on the Series X, so they clean it up, I guess, would probably be the best way to put it. I don't know if like it seemed very smooth. I don't know if they did anything with the frame, the FPS or anything like that, but it's certainly like both the original and the second one that I played through already, like they both look fantastic.
Yeah, the visuals are striking. Like I can't say that I've kind of seen a lot of side by side comparisons necessarily, but playing on the PS5, the Legendary Edition, it looks awesome. It definitely looks or feels like it's a massive visual improvement over the original games when I first played them on 360. You're playing on a Series X, is that right, David?
And it's free through game. Well, free. it's available in
it's
Game
included
Pass.
With
so
Game
it's,
Pass. Yeah, yeah.
I've paid for it one way or another, so I'm playing those. I downloaded the first two so far. I'm playing those versions.
I guess I got the feeling, or when I was playing it, I felt like, wow, this feels like a current gen title. It doesn't feel like a title from, you know, a decade ago or more. It feels like something that could have come out in the last 2 or 3 years And you would have been like, yeah, this makes sense. Like, it's not perfect, and it's not, like, you know, a native PS5 or Xbox Series X game, but what they've done with the visuals is pretty stellar. It does feel like a late PS4 game, and there's not a lot about... of course, the first game, like, some of the gameplay is dated, yeah, but just when you're just looking around and exploring the world and stuff, it does feel like, especially when you go to the planets and on the Mako, and you're just kind of looking at the sky and the vistas and stuff, like, it's still very, very impressive, and it was impressive back then, and I think that for them to kind of replicate that effect now is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's the thing that I found is playing through the first one. I had to look at the date because I was like, yeah, man, they did this in 2007 because this looks really, really incredible. Yeah, like you said, I guess with everything in the space and the environments and stuff, like it seemed like it was very ahead of its time. Yeah, just because when I think of 2007 games, like I certainly wouldn't have pegged it as one of those. Mm-hmm. Like even the non-remastered version that I played, like, it still looked pretty solid for that. I would have assumed it would have been like a late 360 game. Yeah. if I was going to pick it, but it was actually early 360.
Yeah, it was very early because you had all three games in the trilogy come to the 360. So I think that's an incredibly impressive thing too, that all three games of this series launched on a single console during a single generation. Like, that's pretty... Yeah, again, another thing that just doesn't really happen. So, like, obviously, BioWare had really, like, figured out what they wanted to do with these games and, you know, got them to work really well on Xbox, and they found a way to replicate that. I have the Mass Effect trilogy on PS3. I don't know if I've ever played it, though. I did play 2 and 3, I think, on PS3 when those came kind of standalone, but I never played the trilogy, so I've never played the original game, the PS3 version. I've only played the 360 one. But in 2007, it was really hard to believe we were playing a game that looked this good, and they definitely lovingly kind of, you know, brought it forward to a 2021, I'd say. So I can't believe how much I'm enjoying these games. I just flew through the first game. I think my playtime, and this was to get the platinum, was about 15 hours. I was going to say, you know, aside from the visuals, that the gameplay does feel better here. Like the combat, it's not as good as in 2, but it's not as clunky. It feels smoother. You're getting through those segments with a lot less kind of jank to them. I don't know. I guess that's me playing the Legendary Edition. What did you think about the combat and kind of movement and stuff, David, for the version you played?
The version I played, that was the dated part was the combat and the movement. Like, the problem I had is it felt like the aiming was just all over the place. Yeah. Like the reticule, like wherever it was, it just seemed like I was shooting, you know, in a range. It's like wherever I was aiming at it was like almost like a shotgun spray of like whether or not it would hit. So it was really weird. And I guess early on I was thinking like, oh, maybe it's because like the stats, like I'll get stats boosts throughout the game, and all of a sudden like the shooting won't be so ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But it didn't really give up throughout the game. Like, I would say that the biggest weakness of the original game would have been the combat. Yeah. Like it still had this was actually the first time I've played the original Mass Effect. Like, I've only ever played the second one. So so there's a lot of familiarity going back to the first one. Like, it still had that same feeling. Like, it still had the, you know, hide behind something and shoot at people and then, you know, go back to hiding and shoot some more. What I did like in the first game was that there was no ammo. I liked the setup that they had where it was like, okay, you can use your gun to the point where it heats up as you shoot. Yeah. And if you shoot too often, then it overheats and you can't use that gun and you have to switch. Mm. I found the not having to worry about ammo was a very nice kind of quality of life thing that they chose to do back
then. Yeah, see, I'm the other way. I prefer the ammo-based form in Mass Effect 2. I found my guns overheating a lot. I didn't like to switch guns very often. I guess that was my problem. If you switch often, the overheating isn't a big deal. There's also some enemies that they cast an ability on you that overheats your gun, or it doesn't allow the heat to drop. And so I found that kind of annoying. I think it's Sentinel. It's the half engineer, half biotic, half tech, half biotic ability, or job class, I should say. So I was using a lot of abilities to fight, not just the gunplay, and I actually found that pretty fun. normally when I play these games, I do a lot of just the kind of like, I'm just doing the shooting. The sniper rifle was so powerful in the first game. I don't know if they nerfed it or something. It felt a little bit less powerful in the Legendary Edition, or maybe it's just because I was using the powers more. But yeah, to get the Platinum Trophy, you have to use a lot of the powers to finish off enemies or deplete their shields. So I was using my biotic powers and my tech powers a lot, but also using the powers of my teammates, which you can control by going into the combat radial menu. And yeah, I just going back to this game, playing it differently, I think I found it more fun that way. Trying to not do as much of the shooting in the first game, which I think is a weakness, and doing more of the combat powers. And so that was, I think that helped my enjoyment of the combat with this version.
Yeah, I think I probably should have done that, or if I had a thought about it at the time, that probably would have been a better route to go, because I ended up going, I went the route of like whatever the assassin class was, like unsurprisingly. Yeah. And my favorite gun is in both games was the sniper rifle. Like I always like going
so
to that.
Strong.
But I just found that the trying to aim in the first game, trying to aim with the sniper rifle was a hassle. Like I don't know if it was just, like I said, the aiming just seemed off. So sometimes it felt like I was aiming right and it would miss, I'd aim over his head and all of a sudden it's hitting him or something.
Yeah, I think it's better in the Legendary Edition. It was horrible in the first game, but if you did land a hit, it would do so much damage. So it was kind of a risk reward proposition for the version you're playing, I think. But yeah, the combat, it's better in the Legendary Edition. The Mako is better. It's still brutal. Like it's not as bad.
I was curious about that.
It's not as bad as the one you played. It's not as bad as the one you played. Like it's still a little bit easier to handle. But yeah, I definitely don't look forward to those sections. And I don't know if I was saying on Twitter or where, but I couldn't believe how many Mako sections there are. Like it is a massive part of that game. It is every planet you go to, even if it's just like a side mission or something. But even the main quests, like basically every main quest you go on, there is a Mako section to it. Nevaria, Pharos, Ilos probably has one as well. Like they all have a Mako section to them. So you know, thankfully in the Legendary Edition, it's better, you know, better steering, better aiming. But I kind of empathize with you having to go through some of those parts in the original game.
Well, and some of them felt long too, like. The is it Vermeer, the one where the cloning?
Yeah, Vermeer is the one where you make the big decision about whether to save
long.
Rex or, there's a lot of Mako sections on that one as you're even before you get to the Solarian encampment before you actually storm the labs or whatever. Yeah, that's a long Mako segment, and I feel like almost half of the game's exploration on the different planets that you go to is Mako time. And I'd forgotten it's that high a percentage. And so it definitely made me want to stop going to like the random planets just to do like, you know, take out the random base of bad guys, like, which is the same standard dungeon every time. It's the same. The base looks identical basically every time you go to it. It was so funny, but having to do the Mako parts to get to some of those places was pretty bad. Like the side missions are nearly not nearly as good here as they are in the later games.
Yeah, and I didn't even realize until probably halfway through or maybe even later that the Mako has two guns.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was just using the main gun, like the bullets or whatever it is. I didn't even realize that they had a missile launcher.
Yeah, you need to use the cannon. It's pretty strong.
It would have been so useful earlier in the game. But luckily I figured it out that it was, I think it was near the end of the Thorian, I can't remember the colony
Pharos,
they're on, but there's Pharos. So I think I had already gone like most of the way through, and it was on the way back where I think I accidentally hit the trigger button, and I'm like, what was that?
Yeah.
And I like hit it again. I'm like, no, this would have been so much more useful like an hour ago.
That was the first thing I did when I got in the Mako, because I had forgotten entirely how it controls. So I just tested like all the jets and then all the guns and like the movement and stuff. And it's I'm glad that, you know, they did the smart thing of removing those parts from, you know, later entries in the game or later entries in the series. And, you know, it's fine. They obviously learned from that it wasn't, you know, the highlight of the game. And it was fine going back to it a little bit, but I was definitely sick of it by the end of my playthrough.
So did they change the way? So the thing that always confused me was that moving forward was not, like, it wasn't fixed to the front of the Mako. Moving forward was fixed to the direction that my cannon was pointed. And that always, like, confused the hell out of me, because I'd be aiming, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, now I'm moving this other way, because it's like, well, I didn't want to move the body. I just was moving the cannon.
Yeah, I think they're separated now.
I wish they had kept them separate.
I think they're distinct. Oh, okay. Yeah, so I can be backing up, or I can be driving forward but looking back and shooting at a turret while also moving away from the turret. So that, yeah, they must have fixed that as well, because that made some of the bases that have like six turrets to take down, having to like drive forward at them and shoot at them is pretty dangerous. You're bringing it blown up half the time. So they must have addressed that, because I was definitely moving in different directions than I was looking with my cannon. So yeah, that is a stark improvement for sure.
Yeah, that's good, because it got to the point where I, like you said, those turrets could take you out so quick, so I'd have to like get to a spot and then just sit there, and then I'd wait for the missiles to come, move out of the way, and then start firing.
Yeah,
so it was trying to keep my thumbs like moving in the directions and stuff just got pretty frustrating after
that. Yeah, I get that. So this is your first time playing the first game. Like, I don't know if you did like the comic book or if you knew about the story beforehand, but what did you think, like, overall the story or some of the major story beats? Like, was it fun to follow? Like, was it interesting? Like, how did you take the story of Mass Effect?
So most of what I knew was from playing Mass Effect 2. Mm-hmm. So because they do, not all the characters, like the characters are there, I guess, but not all of them are as present in the second one. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of learning a lot of the story. You learn some of the story. So going through the first one for fresh, I thought the story was stronger than the second one. Like, yes, the overall story. Yeah. Like, there's like a clear villain. Like, Saren is clearly the guy that we're trying to stop. Mm-hmm. There was clear villains. Like, the Geth were present throughout the entire game. Like, whenever you're going somewhere, it was always shooting at Geth. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was pretty neat. I don't know, the slow start, I think, was a little jarring, just because I guess like Mass Effect 2 is like very like you're right into it right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a difference going into Mass Effect 1, because like you're going to Eden Prime, and I felt like it's like I didn't really know what was happening. Like, they don't explain a whole lot. Like, it's a very slow, and a lot of the story you actually aren't even learning necessarily in like the main plot. It's almost like through conversations with other people. Like the thing with, you know, why is Saren so mad at humans? Well, I kind of learned that through conversation investigations with other people. Like, oh, well, you know, there's a history with him and Captain Anderson. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, well, what's that? Well, you know, I'll go talk to this person, then he'll give me a tidbit on it, and then I'll talk to this person, and then I can like straight up ask Captain Anderson. But it's like
a lot of the Eden Prime stuff you don't get.
Missed a lot of
a lot of the Eden Prime stuff you don't get until after the mission's done, when you find out like what you're trying to figure out, like what happened, like why did Saren kind of turn on everybody, and then you learn about his history and who he is and his relationship with the council and stuff like that. Like, yeah, you don't get a lot of background until after that mission, after that opening mission is done, and then you go and talk to everybody and explore like the different dialogue options with everybody, go through all the branches of the trees and such on. I think the problem with the opening of that game is it also starts kind of like with one of the weaker parts of the game, which is the combat, right? Like, your first mission, as soon as you're on the Normandy for all of like 5 minutes, and then you're on Eden Prime and you're learning the combat, and that's kind of the tutorial area, and then you meet some of the characters, and you see, like, you know, there is some I can't remember if there's any major choices to make on that first part. I don't really think so, but you figure out, you kind of, very early on, who the enemy is going to be. So it does set up the big bad, I suppose. But also, what's really interesting is the you after that mission, you come back and you tell the council, like, oh, Saren's a bad guy. And the council's like, no, he's not. He's fine. Like, you don't have any proof of that. And so you you have this kind of other secondary quest. You know who the bad guy is, and you've got, I guess, a lot of questions to answer after that opening mission, right? Like, the when Shepard goes up to the Prothean beacon and he gets those visions, and you're trying to figure out what the visions mean. And then the game really opens up at that point when you get back to the Citadel. And not only is the Citadel awesome, like, it's one of the best locations in a video game, I would say, in an RPG, like, just in terms of exploring it, looking around it, all the different creatures that you meet for the first time. Like, that first time being on the Citadel is kind of magical. And I don't know that the other games ever replicate that kind of town feeling, or that home base feeling that the first game does with the Citadel. It really is magical. Meeting the Elcor for the first time, the Hanar, the Asari consort, like, there's just so many cool characters and people on that in that area. But then after that, when you leave the Citadel, you kind of become a Spectre. You've recruited, like, more than half your crew at this point, which I'd forgotten that happens so early in the game. You get so many characters really quickly, and then the world opens up. You can go wherever you want to go next. You know, Nevaria, the ice planet, to follow the Matriarch, who is one of kind of Saren's hench people, I guess. Or you can go to Pharos to you see what's going on with the colony there. You can go recruit Liara. I think she's on Ilos or Ilium. I'm getting those mixed up because they're very similar names, and Ilium is definitely in Mass Effect 2. And not all of the worlds in 1 and 2 kind of overlap. So, yeah, I love when the game opens up and you can kind of choose where you want to go next, because it fits really well with that theme of Western RPGs, of going where you want to go or choosing your own adventure. And so much of that idea is baked into this game.
Yeah, it's funny to see, like, you see the, I guess, fingerprints of the Western RPG. Like, you get to choose your own name, you get to choose your own face, you choose your party members, and then you choose who you actually want to use. Like, even when you have the party members. Yeah, I was surprised to see all the people right away. Yeah. And especially with when I got, like, Garrison Tally, because they were people that I had recognized from the second game, and I was like, oh, there, you know, there's those two. So I kind of immediately was drawn towards them, so I was using them most of the time, because but like you said, they do a good job of creating, like, the story itself is kind of more linear than the second one, I would say, but it's not in the sense that, like, you can still choose the order that you want to do it. Like, the first thing I did was I wanted to get the whole party together, so I immediately went to get Liara.
Yeah, so did I.
And then I think I ended up coming back to the Citadel or something to do a few things there too. But yeah, it's Bioware certainly has this thing where it's like, where, you know, we want to lead you through the story, but we still want to let you do it in the order or however we want to at least give you the illusion of you're building your own story as you go. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What I love about, again, the branching paths and that choice at the beginning, where do you go next with the Normandy, every one of the planets you go to, like the major kind of main story quest that you have to do, there's a ton of side stuff, but you can largely ignore it. You could just do the main stuff. And every one of those ends with, like, a really, really interesting decision. Like, basically, like, who lives and who dies at the end of every planet. And you're gonna feel those repercussions, not just in the second game, but probably in the third game as well. And I just love that. That's my favorite part of this game, is knowing that I could go back, I could go to Nevaria, and I could play that mission. All those, there's like three or four, like, noticeable missions that have different cutscenes depending on which decision you make. And you can double cross people. You can tell one person one thing and then, you know, backstab them right away. Or you can, you know, you can take your information and, you know, use it however you see fit. I think Nevaria is probably my favorite planet in Mass Effect 1, because it's so interesting the different options you have for that game, or for that main mission, how you get to open the garage, to open up the Mako, and then go in and find Matriarch Benezia kind of in the tower, the research tower, I guess, that's later on in the planet. But that opening hub area of Nevaria is fascinating. And yeah, just I mean, Vermeier, you know, you have major choices there about who lives and who dies. You know, Rex is a party member. Like, you have a choice whether he kind of lives or dies. And if you don't have, this happened to you, right? Like, you didn't have enough Paragon or Renegade.
I went there too early
to solve it. Yeah. And so, but you don't, yeah. but you don't know to go there too early or not, right? I don't think there's anything in the game that sort of really directs you.
There's nothing that.
No. Vermeier is Vermeier one of the first options that they give you, or does it open up a little bit later? I feel like it might not be one of the first.
It had to be early.
I don't know if it's one of the original three. I think the three missions you get are Novaria, Pharos, and then picking up Liara. I think those are the first three. And I think you probably did Liara, and then Vermeier opens up. So
I think that was the case.
So I think
because I ended up going to the Pharos after that, and then Vermeier. I actually didn't need, So I really should have done the Matriarch.
Yeah. But if you had done more side quests, though, you could have got Paragon or Renegade score from those side quests and then had enough for Vermeier. But the idea that you're not prepared enough to save Rex, I think, is a really cool thing. And I'm sure a lot of players would get there. They'd get there and they'd be like, "Oh, I'm not kind of capable. I'm not a strong enough leader to defuse this situation. So I'm going to come back to this mission later. You know, like I don't want Rex to die." Like, I really like him, so, and I want him to show up in later games if that's possible. So, just fascinating stuff.
Well, and I ended up resetting that scene. I must have did it six times because there's, like, different trees or stuff. And I went through every possible tree, and, there was no way
to save him.
You still
couldn't save
him, So, I joked to you, I think, at the time, it was clear to me that there was no way that I could save Rex. So I ended up going the route of just killing him myself because the old I'd rather be feared than thought weak. Yep.
Well, that would be that's the Krogan way, you know. You took him out the way he would want to be taken out, I suppose. But do you shoot him in a cutscene, or do you actually fight him?
No, it's just a cutscene. Yeah, so you just shoot him in the head and he drops, and everyone around him's like, is everything good? And then Shepard's like, what?
It is now.
And then the Solarian comes over and like, well, that's regrettable.
Yep.
So should we just throw his body in the swamp, or should we actually bury him?
That's hilarious. The Solarian's one of my favorite races, which is, they're just so dry, right? And we'll talk about this more in the second game, but Morden, one of the characters in the second game of Solarian, he talks about, and I hadn't remembered this, but he talks about how, Solarians process emotions really quickly. Like it's not that they don't feel, it's just that they feel and like get over it very fast. And so when you see things like that happen in the first game, like that interaction you had with the Solarian captain, or their willingness to kind of like, you know, we're not going to mourn, you know, lives lost here necessarily, or we're not going to do it. We're not going to dwell on it. You know, they're going to go on to the next thing pretty fast. You learn more about the races in later games that informs what they do in the first game, which is another fascinating part of just playing these games consecutively, is how you learn retroactively about different things that happened in earlier on.
Well, I think one of the interesting things with the first game, especially having played the second one right after, is that the first game options seem less clear cut than the second. In the sense of like good versus evil, I guess.
Yeah.
Because the options don't necessarily, like, I'm looking at like, I guess I'll use an example. Like there's the, when you're in where the Thorian is, and there's like an option of like whether you allow these experiments that are going on, but they give like very valid options of, or very valid reasons of like why you should choose option A or choose option B. And neither one is like a great option, or neither one is like a clear cut, like, okay, this is the right way to go. I felt like they were very, very more abstract or like just more vague, and or you just don't get the same, like, I feel good about going this one. This is clearly the good guys.
Everything's morally gray, right? It's not black and white. And even though what's funny is they'll still assign Paragon or Renegade points to one decision or the other, even if they don't feel like good or bad options, right? I guess it's more like, it's usually Paragon for which one benefits, you know, everybody, and Renegade might just benefit only humans, for example, or something like that. Or, you know, Paragon, Paragon, if you help everybody, all the different races, but if you just do something for the Alliance or the Council, maybe they might maybe not consider that Renegade or something like that. But I think, again, another strength of the game, just not knowing. It does a good job of emulating kind of real life choices, right? You don't always know what's good and bad. like, okay, let's say testing medicine on animals, like, it's not ethically a good thing necessarily, right? If it's hurting or killing animals to make medicine for humans, it's not ethically a good thing necessarily, but it could help us, right? So, like, it's not so easy to make those decisions, and so it puts, I guess, difficult choices in the game. I think that's, again, because it's not black and white, it is hard. Like, you sit on that choice screen, like, man, I don't know what to do. I'm even even if you know who your shepherd is, you know you're going Paragon or Renegade.
Yeah.
You don't always know clearly which one you want to go for to get those points. Even like, it's not always that the top left or top right choice on the dialogue wheel is always Paragon. You do have to read, kind of read between the lines, or do the investigate option and find out what the find out the whole story before making that choice. I don't know if in the first game the dialogue options are ever colored. Are they red and blue colored sometimes when they open up, right?
I don't, because
in the second game they definitely have that, where like you see the Paragon blue and the Renegade red on the choices, but I don't think all
Mine's
of them
clear-cut.
If they are at all, they certainly aren't all blue and red choices in the first game. So you don't always know. And it is a compelling part of the game. It's just every time you play, you might just be in a different mindset. Or trying to play a different shepherd character, kind of role playing a different character, and then you're gonna just you're gonna do different things and see different cutscenes, and love it.
Well, in a lot of cases, your squad mates aren't even that very helpful in that manner either, because the squad mates themselves are shades of gray.
Yes,
like they're not as clear cut in their goodness or badness as you would think. Like, you kind of assume that the two humans on your team would kind of emulate the same, you know, moral compass that Shepard has, but Ashley is clearly a racist.
Yeah, oh, like, very much so.
She's not even really hiding it per se. Like, it's just like humans are the best, and you know, screw everything else.
And it's not even just like interactions with her alone. Like, even during like group meetings, she'll still have that kind of xenophobia coming out, right? Like, she. Yeah, it's a huge part of her character, but even Caden's not perfect either, right? Like, he's kind of been traumatized by his biotic, the biotic implants or the testing that was done on him, and so he's got a fear of things too that informs what he says to you. I think you get a little bit more. At least I didn't get to know him as well in the first game as I did in the second one, but you learn a lot about him. I guess if you save him and he shows up later on, you learn more about him. I see. Now I'm getting the games confused. Like,
he's not even in two. He wasn't in my playthrough two.
Yeah. So you learn about him by talking to him on the Mass Effect ship, but he does show up in two.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess if you save him, right? So
yeah, I was going to say it depends on what happens in one, because there's in two for me in two, Caden. I don't want to get into spoilers, but I made Caden do something that he was not available in two.
It's the same. So Ashley and Caden, that's the choice, right? When we talk about people living and dying, it's not just Rex. Vermeier is a hugely consequential planet, because you also have to basically make a choice between Caden or Ashley. Seeing how those choices play out is so, so interesting, because it's not just like, you know, who did you choose? But then it's characters asking you why. Why did you do this? Or how did you make that choice? And that's tough. Like, even as a player, like, I don't know how I made that choice. Like, maybe I choose Ashley because I'm trying to romance her. Or I choose Caden because I think his abilities are better. Like, hey, how do you make that choice about which characters are going to move forward or not? Like, or, you know, what's going to happen to them? So many interesting situations that the game puts you in this first one, which I don't think the second one does as well. You're not put into so many consequential decisions, or they don't feel as big or weighty as they do in the first game. Like, there's so many live or die moments in Mass Effect 1 that I mean, of course, there's the suicide mission in Mass Effect 2, but that's a little bit different because everything's kind of building up to that. It's not necessarily like big choices you're making.
But the thing with the suicide mission, and I think it kind of goes through Mass Effect 2 as a whole, is that the answers or the decisions, there's a clear-cut right choice in Mass Effect 2. Like, it feels like most of the dialogue things, most of the like, if you're choosing Paragon or Renegade, there's always a clear choice depending on the route you want to go. And then in the suicide mission, there's there's a little leeway they give you depending on like how you want to do it, but for the most part, like when you're choosing the specializations of where to send people, like you don't have that many options. Like I think there's maybe like two options for every specialist that you have to choose while on that suicide mission, assuming that you want to get the best ending anyway. Yeah. So it's not, and to a certain extent, you kind of already know who those people should be too. Like there's a very strong hint of, you know, we need someone to do this, and who happens to be a specialist in this? Yeah, and I'm sitting there going, well, clearly it's, you know,
someone with a tech power, you're going to send them to do some engineering work or whatever. Like that just makes sense. But there's less of those kind of choices in the first game. Like I said, it just does feel like you're making life or death decisions multiple times in the first game. And every time it gives me pause, I got to stop and think, what are the ramifications of this? Like, how is this going to affect later games? A couple times I looked it up. I wanted to make sure that, like, you know, the kind of game I was trying to set up for Mass Effect 3 was going to be there if I made these choices. Like, if I make a choice in 1, how does it change what happens in 3? And I think this is, we'll get there eventually. We can talk about it more next episode of the series. But I think people were so disappointed about 3 because the monumental decisions you make in 1 and 2 didn't pay off the way people wanted them to. They just kind of turned out to be like kind of numbers, right? Or brief mentions. Whereas the choices in 1 have big impacts in Mass Effect 2 that do play out, that are tied to cutscenes and further decisions and side quests. And 3 didn't do that as much. 3 kind of like just kind of tied off things nicely, but out without any major detail or a lot of thought put into them. And so I think that's was just one of the things that's disappointing about 3. And I hope we'll get a chance to talk about it eventually. The first one, the characters are great. Like, who did you really gravitate towards? You said you had Garrus and Tally on your team, but, like, just in terms of dialogue and talking to people, who else did you like in the game? Not just player characters.
I liked the interactions with Captain Anderson.
Yeah, he's great.
Because there's, like, well, first of all, like, I really like that actor.
Yeah.
I think he's in a lot of good stuff that I like. And that's the other thing about the Mass Effect is that, like, they really put some dough out to get some good voice actors.
Keith David was Captain Anderson, and everyone has seen Keith David in a movie before. He's been an actor for a long time. I think he's been a voice actor for a long time as well. He's so good in this game.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. The cast is filled with kind of talented voice actors, and not just people necessarily known for voice acting either.
Yeah. No, like, when I heard it, like, I think, like, oh, he's an actor in Hollywood. Like, that was more, like, you know, I'm hearing that, especially, like, in the second one, you get, like, Martin Sheen.
Yeah.
So it's definitely, like, it seems like they're going after the Hollywood angle. But, I gravitated towards that. And, yeah, definitely, like, Tali and Garrus because of my, it's not even if I hadn't have played the second one first, I still feel like I would have gravitated towards the two of them the most anyway.
Yeah.
Just because, like, Garrus just seems cool with his, like, you know, he's in C-Sect and he's supposed to have these set of rules that he's following. And then he's, like, learning that, like, you know, the rules aren't really helping us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, do what needs to be done. And then Tali's kind of, like, innocence to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Like, she just seems like maybe the most morally centered of the group. Mm-hmm. Like, especially since, like, her whole existence depends on servicing others, like her people. Yeah. There's millions of her people, and she, like, they're only alive because they're looking out for each other. Like, if they had this individual outlook, like, the migrant fleet wouldn't exist anymore.
The Quarians also live kind of, obviously, you know, they live in a very odd existence. Like, they have to be in their environmental suits. Like, they are basically, like, allergic to or sensitive to everything around them. But the big thing about the Quarians is they created the Geth, right? They created who is basically your central enemy, or one of your central enemies in this first game. And kind of a force that kind of terrorizes the universe, right? The Geth setting up everywhere. You learn more about the Geth in the second game, but in the first game, they are wholly bad. Like, they are, yeah, they're kind of terrorizing people, killing people, and the Quarians, it's kind of like them trying to make up for that, maybe a little bit with Tali's attitude. It's like, she's innocent, but she's also kind of like, oh man, like, we screwed up. Like, we caused this big problem for everybody, and now it's kind of out of control, and it's her job a little bit to fix it, or to kind of, like, to feel bad about it a little bit, too. Like, they're, so much of what the Quarians are trying to do is not only survive, like, their planet was basically taken over by the Geth, but now they're trying to fix this problem that they started that is affecting everybody. So they're kind of, that as a race, they're kind of in an odd position.
Well, and that made her giving up her, or at least putting her pilgrimage aside, it made that, the decision that she made to do that, it made more sense to me that she so quickly would say, like, oh, well, this is more important, so I'm going to put my pilgrimage to the side for now. Like, that made more sense, because it's like, okay, well, they kind of created the problem. Here's people working on fixing the problem.
Yeah.
So, you know, it makes, I saw her mindset of, like, okay, this is why this is more important than working for my people at this point.
Yeah. So. Joker's really good. He's the pilot of the ship. That's another Hollywood voice. That's Seth Green.
Yeah.
His character changes so much from the first game to the second game. A lot of the characters do, and we'll talk about that when we talk about Mass Effect 2. But he's so cocky in the first game. It's hilarious. Like, he's so sure of himself, and, like, he's got this debilitating disease that kind of makes his bones really brittle, or he's more prone to to bones breaking or something like that?
Not hollow, but yeah, like, I think the calcium in his bones, they're like further apart or something.
Yeah, so his bones are
really
brittle.
Like, he can walk around, but yeah.
So he kind of limps around around with help, but he could you know, seriously hurt himself at any moment. So he's a really, I guess he kind of compensates that with his skill as a pilot, and kind of that's why he's so confident in this one thing, in piloting the Normandy and taking care of the ship. And I really like him as a character. But I think my party was usually, I was romancing Liara in this playthrough, and what happened to me, which was kind of funny, so there's three characters that male Shepherd can romance, Liara and Ashley and Caden.
And Tally?
Not in the first game.
Oh, Caden. Yeah, right.
So, those are the only three for male Shepherd. It might even be the same for female Shepherd too. No, I'm confused. I think female Shepherd can romance Caden, Garrus, and Liara, I think. I haven't played a Fem Shep run in a long time. But anyway, I was romancing Liara, and what happened to me was Liara and Ashley were fighting, because Ashley is always fighting with the aliens on the ship, especially Liara. Anytime Liara says something, Ashley kind of takes issue with it. And so basically they got to a point where they were fighting, maybe between missions, and I had a conversation with the two of them, and it led to what I thought was going to be a joke response. Like, it wasn't like, pick one of us. It was kind of like, oh, you know, what should we do? I'm like, oh, why can't I have both of you? And then Ashley got super pissed off about that, and she storms out, and I guess that ended my relationship potential with Ashley. And so Liara was the, I could only have a relationship with Liara from that point on. Ashley basically wouldn't talk with me, and that was fine. I thought that was going to be a joke response, though. I didn't think that would cut off their relationship options with either of them. I thought I'd just be like, oh, no, I thought that one of them said, like, oh no, you got to pick one.
Ease the tension, I guess.
Yeah, I was trying to do. I'm like, oh, stop fighting. Like, here's a joke. Like, you know, let's just, you know, obviously I'm not necessarily like proposing a three-way, but I'm trying to joke my way out of it, which would maybe be my like default response to situations like that. So I say that Ashley breaks off. She storms off. I have a relationship with Liara, and we'll talk about Liara in the second game, because she's not a playable character, but she does show up as part of the DLC. And I really can't wait to talk about the Mass Effect 2 DLC. I think it's fascinating. Did you get a chance to play any of the Mass Effect 1 DLC, David? I don't know if it comes with the version that you played.
No, there's no DLC in 1 or 2.
Right.
And in the Game Pass version, unfortunately.
Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to think of... there's two missions that I'm thinking of. Pinnacle Station is one. The other one is Bring Down the Sky. I'm trying to think of what they have to do. One of them, I think, has to do with, like, stopping an asteroid from colliding into a planet or something like that. It's pretty cool. You're actually, like, driving around the Mako and visiting these different bases, shutting down these giant torches... They're basically propelling an asteroid into a planet, and so you got to stop the Batarians from sending this asteroid to destroy a whole planet. And that the cool thing about the DLC was that it's actually attached to trophies in the Legendary Edition. So to get the platinum, you had to do these main DLC missions. So I was probably going to do them anyways, but it was nice to kind of be enticed further to do them. But yeah, I'm sorry, I was going to say that I really like Rex as a character. I think he's he's gruff, but like once you kind of like get to know him and become friendly with him, he's kind of a really stand up guy, and he's very, you know, becomes your good friend, and he feels like he's always got your back. So I really liked Rex in this game too.
Well, I just find the whole dynamic on the ship pretty neat because it the ship acts like a hub world, and you just get to walk around and have these conversations with people and get to learn their histories and stuff, and I think that's a very unique mechanic in the game that I really enjoyed, like just getting to know everybody. Like, and then there's on top of the fact that you have like your main party members, there's even like the doctor, I think it's Dr. Chakwas.
Yeah.
Like you could go talk to her and then she'd be like apologizing for Caden for his like PTSD and stuff. Just so many fine details that are on the, even just on the ship that you can walk around and learn.
Yeah, I love the idea of like between missions you go and talk to the party members and they almost always have something different to say unless you spurn them in some way. But if you're friendly with them and you talk to them, you can kind of learn more about their races and their histories and just get to know them, and which is great, and you want to do that because when you meet them again, like that stuff kind of pays off, like learning about them and knowing who they are and then seeing what happens in the second game. Like there is a lot of payoff between the first and second game that makes the first one not only worth playing, but worth playing like thoroughly.
Yeah. Like there's definitely, they do a great job of, like you said, with the continuation, like you feel very compelled to complete each one so that you could see how it affects the next one. And yeah, that's really unique. Like I can't even think of another game where it's that pronounced that, you know, yes, you know, maybe you got 10 hours in the first one and you're ready to go on the second one. It's like, nah, you really want to finish the first one so that you can have that experience going into the second one. And it's amazing how they were able to seamlessly make that work, at least for between the first two.
Maybe we'll talk about Saren for a minute before we go to last call. I think Saren is something that is missing from the first game because he's a central single figure that, you can kind of sympathize with him a little bit. Like his motivations make sense. You have to dig around for them, right? They're not necessarily clear cut, but the fact that he has a noble cause, right? Like he believes that, one of the central conflicts of the first game is that the Reapers are coming and they're going to take over the universe and kill all sentient beings or enslave them or whatever. And Saren's kind of like, you know, this is happening. We can't really stop this. We might as well kind of just help with it or just let it happen kind of naturally. Like I kind of believe what he's saying, but then you kind of learn about him throughout the game that he's sort of being manipulated. And that the ship he's on, which is you're introduced to the ship really early. It's called the Sovereign, which is basically a Reaper, right? It is either a Reaper ship or a Reaper itself. The Reapers have this ability to kind of convince people or persuade them gradually, and so you see Saren, I think initially believing something on his own, but then I guess as the game goes on, it becomes more and more brainwashed and kind of maniacal, and he kind of turns into that ultimate villain by the end.
Yeah, he'd be considered like a tragic villain in the sense that he may not have been as villainous had the true villain. I guess it's one of those things that's, I guess I'm kind of used to it with all the JRPGs, is that To find out there's like, well, there's really like this other villain that's the real villain, not that, not the villain that you've been thinking is the villain the entire game.
Yeah. I mean, I think his logic kind of does make sense. Like if he does believe, if he's seen or been told by these Reapers, like this is how powerful they are. They've done this before. They've killed all beings in the universe before. It's going to happen again. We might as well just kind of like help them and maybe work with them or something, like kind of like be obsequious and be subservient. Yeah. So it's not as bad. Like it kind of makes some sense.
Yeah. I think my only critique of that would be is that I wish there'd been more face-to-face interactions with Saren.
Yeah. Yeah. Like he's more behind the scenes.
Yeah. Cause he's more behind the scenes. Like you do run into him and stuff, like the information that you're finding out about him is always seems to be like the majority of his second hand.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you go to the Citadel and he's there via like holograph or whatever you see him initially, but then you find out about him specifically from just the people there after he leaves. Like, you end up, Shepard gets shot down and then all of a sudden it's like, well, this is what happened with him and this is what happened. And then you go to talk to Captain Anderson and he's like, well, this is why he hates humans. And then it just seems like he's more in the background for too long.
Yeah.
I would have preferred a little bit more face-to-face, or if they had inserted him maybe into more missions where it's like you see him and he kind of, I don't know if he, like, it doesn't have to be super villain, like, here is my plan. It doesn't have to be that obvious, but he maybe just more, some more interactions, some more face-to-faces or something, you know?
Yeah, it's not really until Vermeier that you get that encounter, that major encounter with him, and there's kind of like a boss fight with him where he's like riding that flying pad or flying disc around, and then after you shoot him down, there's like a good conversation there where he kind of feels like he's a little bit defeated by everything. Like humanize is an odd word to use because he's a Turian, but it does help you see him in a different way. I think that scene in the game, and I won't spoil, but I think once you get to that point, you can maybe understand him a little bit more. And I think that's the point where he gains a little bit of that tragic figure kind of credibility or character, I suppose.
Yeah, like still, I would still consider him like a successful villain. Like it. He definitely had that air about him that made him villainous. He was believable, and it was having just the central person to kind of put the angst towards. Like it was all about him, right? Like stopping Saren, stopping Saren. So it was good to have a focus in the game.
If we can do a quick spoiler minute to talk about the ending, maybe with him.
Sure.
So everyone, if you haven't played through the Mass Effect 1 and you're doing that now or you're going to do that, maybe just go out. I'll keep this to 60 seconds and I'll time it. So if you have enough Paragon or Renegade, you can take out Saren before the final fight, right? I think it might even, I don't know if it skips a boss fight, but it is a kind of a major event that happens in the game or a major decision you can make. You can basically like have a conversation with him and convince him to kind of let his guard down, or he fights off the persuasion or the brainwashing of the Reaper long enough for you to shoot him in the head and take him down. And I love that moment in the game. I totally forgotten about it, but I had enough Paragon to kind of talk him down, and then you shoot him in the head, and then he kind of falls through the glass down to the bottom level where you end up fighting him again as he kind of gets taken over. But I just thought that was a really cool moment in the game that I'd completely forgotten about.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol. Get going.
For those of you who just skipped ahead to get past that spoiler, or if you're still with us, they are now starting Last Call. So for this particular one, we're taking a look at what we would like to see from the next Mass Effect game. So I believe there's been rumors out that BioWare is working on a new, I don't know what this is going to be, really. All we really know is that they're working on something Mass Effect related. So I guess while we wait to find out what that is, in the meantime, we can kind of speculate and or throw out our well wishes. So is there anything in particular, Jordan, that you would like to see BioWare go on with when they're tackling a brand new Mass Effect in the next in this current genre or generation of consoles?
Yeah, it's so hard. You know, like I would love another trilogy like centered around one character, maybe in a totally different part of the universe or something like that. But a lot of the same mechanics we've already seen, you know, like the big decisions of Mass Effect 1, the carryover from one game to a second to a third, the very interesting like character moments and like the building up the team elements of 2 are great. The loyalty missions, some of them are really, really fun. Tally's loyalty mission in 2 is outstanding. It's actually hilarious how much longer some of the loyalty missions are compared to others in the second game.
Yeah.
But the end of the loyalty missions often have like a really, really key decision. And with like 10 characters in the second game, there's a lot of very interesting choices, even if they don't have major repercussions like they do in the first game. So, yeah, more of that. It's tough to think about what I want from the next game. I want it to be polished. Like, I felt like Andromeda really wasn't ready to release when it came out. It had a lot of bugs. It had, you know, just glitches and hiccups that made the experience not as smooth and enjoyable. Like, the ending of that game is completely ruined for me because so many, like, cutscenes just kind of didn't load properly. And so I kept getting taken out of the experience by the lack of polish of Andromeda. I think Andromeda, some of the planet exploration is very repetitive. I didn't love that. I think what's great about Mass Effect 2 is that every new place you go to feels different. Every new base you go to feels different, for the most part. So, yeah, keep up that variety. I love the exploration. I love the going to different planets. And I know maybe I'm one of the few people who actually likes scanning the planets for resources. I think it's kind of cathartic and a nice kind of break between missions. I really like that from the second game. It sucks, but I love Shepard. I would love to see more of Shepard. I don't think they're going to do that. But this cast, man, if they brought back the cast from, or if they brought back the characters from the first three games, I would welcome that. Like I think you get so attached to them, you go through so much with them, that it's a shame to kind of leave them all behind. They kind of it feels, you know, bittersweet, I guess. And so, if Morden came back somehow, if Grunt from Mass Effect 2 came back, I can't even remember the characters from 3, but even the DLC characters from 2 came back, or Liara showed. Like, just find a way to make the parts of the world you've already been in carry over, you know, not just the Mass Effect relays, but you know, events or specific people in this universe. If you could see them again, I think that'd be really neat.
Yeah, for me, I'm kind of bouncing back and forth because I kind of like the idea of starting fresh, like starting a brand new trilogy, just kind of maybe in that world. I don't know if it'd be before the times or after the times, but at the same time, then you talk about how great the cast is, and then I'm like, well, I kind of want to see Tally and Garrus again. Yeah, so it's really tough because it's like, yeah, I've, as someone who played, like I said, I only played the Mass Effect 2, but it left such an impact on, impression on me, mm-hmm. that I, like, playing it again, I remember so much of that game. And
yeah,
a lot of times, like, I'll play a game and if too much time goes past, or even a little time goes past, I'm already, like, forgetting details of it. But Mass Effect 2, like, as I'm going through it, I remembered everything. Like, it's mm-hmm. I'm amazing to me that it's still imprinted in my mind. It's,
yeah.
So it does a lot. So, I mean, that says a lot on its own. And there's so many things, like, I guess it wouldn't be a Mass Effect game if it didn't have the same type of combat, like that mm-hmm. kind of third person over the shoulder, hiding behind things and shooting. Yep, like, I guess they got to stick with that. I hope they stick with the same, like, I like the way that they made a variety of weapons. Like, you can have a sniper, an assault rifle, a hand cannon, and yep. And like some kind of laser gun all in like one loadout. I think that's pretty neat.
Maybe some more weapon types they could introduce, you know, some different types of weapons, yeah. more melee weapons, or, you know, laser crossbows or something like that. I don't know. Like, in the second game, there are a lot of different heavy weapons, but like your basic weapons are kind of the same throughout pretty much. And yeah, I think it'd be interesting to do that. Maybe some space dogfighting, add some different like gameplay mechanics like that would be pretty cool. Like some big space
control
fights.
The Normandy.
yeah, I think it'd be just segments like that where you are controlling things you've never controlled before. just hopefully without the, you know, the shaky mass, the shaky, shaky Mako controls, you know, if it, yeah. we don't obviously don't want it like that. Even the, there's a vehicle in the second game called the Hammerhead, which I don't think is super fun to use either. So maybe vehicle movement and combat isn't their strength necessarily, but something in space would be cool. So I'd like to see some dogfighting or something like that.
Yeah, like story-wise, I'd like to see them go back to something more akin to the first Mass Effect, where there is like a clear villain or clear enemies, and but the choices are less clear.
Yeah,
I think I'd like to see that more, a little bit more cohesive story that way. Mm-hmm. Definitely hope that they keep the open world exploration. Like I can't imagine it. Like it's BioWare and it's going to be a Western RPG, so you just kind of assume that that would stick around. So hopefully they go with that.
Like I don't want the colonizer narrative of Andromeda. Like I don't like the idea of like we're the first humans going to this new place. I don't like that as much. I'd rather be in an established universe or galaxy or set of galaxies where you're an interloper or a new person coming to an unfamiliar place, but not setting up camp there. You know, like, take me to a city filled with new people and new races. Like, let's go to a Hanar city. Let's go to an Elcor city. I can't remember Thane. I can't remember Drell, I think it is.
Like, Drell.
Let's go see where those characters' homeworlds are, and, like, let's go visit them and do stuff there. Like, I'd rather do that than, like, go to some barren planet and set up a, you know, basic colony there. I didn't find that part of Andromeda very compelling. And normally I like that stuff, but it just didn't work there in that game.
Well, I guess that's the thing is, like, my favorite places in Mass Effect 2 would be, like, Omega, Ilium, Citadel. Like, those kind of thriving places with lots to look at and lots to do. Like, I'd rather have less places that are more detailed than kind of, like, cookie-cutter or procedural-generated places that just, like, rocks and caves and stuff. Like, I'd rather be able to go somewhere and be able to really kind of get immersed in that area. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it'd be neat to go to, like, a Drell home world and then see everything and then maybe the migrant something with the migrant fleet, like, be able to go through that or something in more detail, or just these kinds of places. I prefer the more exploration, like, you're taking these humans out of maybe you're putting them into systems they've never been before, not to colonize, but to explore, like, to learn. Like, I like the learning aspect more of it than I think that's more of an interesting take on it than, you know, humans taking over the galaxy.
Yeah, I agree. I think it'd be cool if they did something with time travel. I think that's probably an area you could explore. It's tough to go from the Mass Effect trilogy, which is basically an all-out war for the universe with, like, basically every race involved fighting the Reapers, to what do we do next? So I don't know. Yeah. Like, you know, I think time travel would be cool. I'm thinking, like, you know, Star Trek kind of themes, you know, the way that Star Trek goes to different planets and, so, you know, meeting different races every time. Like, introduce a few new races, maybe see how they interact with the established canon that you already have. I think my number one is that you need a strong protagonist. Like, Shepard, whether you go, you know, male Shepard or female Shepard, like, that character makes the series. Like, without him or her kind of, like, being that kind of focal point of the game and, like, having a reputation, having, like, interesting dialogue and good voice work, like, you need that to kind of foreground however many games you make after whatever these next games are going to look like. So, you know, it doesn't have to be Shepard, but, man, make it, like, as compelling as Shepard, you know? And I know that's hard, but that's what I want.
Yeah, it'll be in the future, and it'll be someone from, like, Shepard's bloodline or something.
Yeah, just do it. Like, it's so, like, contrite and, like, tropey, but, like, I don't care. Like, yeah, Shepard 2.0, let's do it.
Yeah, the time travel thing will be they've pulled Shepard from back in time to, because he's the only one that can take on the threat of today's galaxy. I mean,
that's basically the story of 2. Like, he's dead, and he's dead, and we brought him back. Clone him. And then Mass Effect 4, we went back in time and cloned him. Like, he's still back. Yeah, like, right. It's not exactly him, it's a clone of Shepard. I don't know. Like,
there was some armor that was in display in the Citadel or something, and they took, like, a strand of his hair out of his helmet. And
here, I'll give it to you right now. You know how, I don't know if you've met Legion in Mass Effect 2. Legion wears a piece of Shepard's armor.
There you go.
As part of his, like, Geth armor, I suppose. So there, that's the story. So Legion, you know, his Geth armor is harvested for, you know, reviving Shepard or something. I don't know.
Oh, there you go. The Geth clone Shepard to lead them.
Yeah, Shepard's a villain in the next game.
Yeah. There you go. It sells itself.
I don't know why BioWare's not paying us for these ideas, but...
I know.
Yeah. At any rate, good discussion of the game. Like, I can't wait to talk about the second one and probably the third, maybe the third one eventually. But yeah, hopefully everyone enjoyed this discussion of Mass Effect. It's a fantastic game. The series is well worth getting into. It holds up well on its own, but with the Legendary Edition, it's going to be one. I think it's going to be one of the Game of the Year, topics this year is whether people. We always do this. Like, does a remake or a remaster qualify for Game of the Year? And we're going to have those discussions again at the end of the year, December and January, when people talk about whether Mass Effect Legendary Edition should be up for those awards. But I just hope that this is the start of BioWare's return to prominence. You know, they fell off a cliff really hard, and maybe this is the beginning of their redemption arc. I really hope that that's the case. But that we've got, it's probably the next Dragon Age game to come, and then Mass Effect somewhere down the line. I don't know if we'll see that at E3 or what we'll see in the next year or two, but they certainly seem to be riding high off this game.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, hopefully it rekindles everyone's fascination with the franchise, and more to come.
I think everyone's been talking about it. You've got a lot of new fans that are going to be clamoring for more Mass Effect and more BioWare after this, so that's all good. But I think that'll do it for our Mass Effect episode. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. We will be talking about Mass Effect 2 soon, so stay tuned for that if you're playing the Legendary Edition or the any form of the trilogy along with us. Like David said, it's on Game Pass. So if you've got an Xbox with Game Pass, you can try it out there. And it sounds like it's still well worth going back, even if that's the version you play. Like, it's free. It's free if you have Game Pass. And you could even just start with the second game. I think you can do, like, some kind of comic panel setup to... do the decisions for the games. I don't know if that's part of the Xbox version of it, but for the PS2 version, you could just do like a comic strip kind of thing of choosing decisions to set up your character from the first game. I don't know. I'm not sure if there's something like that built into what you saw, David.
Not maybe in the third one, but not in the second one.
Yeah. I think it might be even in the Legendary Edition. You don't have to play the first game. You could just import some decisions through this comic strip thing. But I would say the first game's not that long. It's really, probably 2/3 or 3/4 of the length of the second game. The second game just has a lot more extra stuff to do, and even the main stuff takes longer. But to platinum, the second game took me about 20-21 hours or so. And it was only 14 or 15 for the first game. So that kind of give you an idea of the relative length of those. But good episode. We'll be talking about more Mass Effect soon. David, what do we have on the schedule coming up for the podcast or even for Advent time?
We got, I know Persona 4 Golden is coming up. We have a non-spoiler episode and a spoiler cast for the Advent time show.
Mm-hmm.
We also got a couple topics coming up, an episode on quality of life mechanics. We also have a Father's Day special coming up. And then lastly, we have a crossover come in about a month or so with Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link, with the Talking Nintendo podcast.
Oh, I can't wait. I love that game. It's brutal, and you probably should just use save states, but I still love that game. The music and the style of it. I've got a lot of nostalgia. I played that a ton as a kid, and I've got some good stories about that one. But yeah, lots of good stuff coming up on the Mage. We'll hope you will join us again soon. If you're listening on podcast player, you leave us a review. 5 stars would be awesome. It gives us increased visibility. We've got a Discord you can join. Lots of cool people on there talking about games all the time. But I think that's all. Anything else we want to plug, Dave, before we get out of here?
No, I think we've pretty much covered it.
Cool. Yeah. So I've got, I think I've mentioned this before, but I've got a Persona 4 Golden Timeless Games piece. You can check it out on my Twitter at wristman64 or on NintendoWorldReport.com for the write-up. And there's a video embedded there too. Check that out. But we'll wrap up here. Thanks again, everybody. And we'll talk to you again next week.
Bye.